Hey everybody, welcome to episode 122 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back, welcome aboard. If you listened to the previous episode, you heard my announcement that Erica and I are leaving the US and moving to Spain for an undetermined amount of time. And as of this recording, we are exactly 5 weeks away. So a lot of our time is going to preparing for that move, but making sure to also get you these podcast episodes. Today's episode is one that I think many of you will be excited about. I am speaking with Glenn Van Pesky. If his name doesn't sound familiar to you, Gossamer Gear probably does. He is the founder of Gossamer Gear, but he is also a retired civil engineer, an entrepreneur, a father, a philanthropist, and the author of the new book, Take Less, Do More. Earlier this year in March, I took a big road trip across the Western United States and I recorded a few podcast episodes. And this is one of those episodes. Glenn and I met in Compass Park in Bend, Oregon one morning, and we recorded this episode. We talked about ultralight gear, his career, a boyhood cross-country bike trip, the realities of writing this book. So why don't we go now back to March of 2024 in Compass Park, Bend, Oregon, and talk to Glenn Van Pesky.
Hi, I'm Glenn Van Pesky. I live in Bend, Oregon. I'm a retired civil engineer, currently dishwasher, philanthropist, entrepreneur. Along the way, I accidentally started a backpacking company, Gossamer Gear, and I'm just enjoying life.
So you are known for your backpacking gear through Gossamer Gear and probably just for backpacking in general. So we'll do the thing that we typically do on this show, and we'll rewind back to early life and discuss the path that got you there. So did you grow up as a guy who was in the outdoors? Did that come to you later in life? What brought you there?
I grew up in Southern California. My dad, mom and dad, took us kids camping. And this was camping, you know, in state parks. I just remember always having a good time, just the smell of the trees and the sun on the pine needles and just the rocks and birds, and I just being outside was cool. And then when my parents got divorced, when I was in fourth grade, we moved back to Western Massachusetts, and my mom joined the Appalachian Mountain Club, and we would go on day hikes, basically long day hikes, some of them I remember. I guess I've been outside most of my life. Probably a pivotal point was when I graduated high school in 1976. I rode my bicycle back to California with a couple friends. So
from Massachusetts?
From Massachusetts. So 4,200 miles in about 6 weeks. And that was like the first big adventure that I kind of thought of and planned, if you can use that word. Pretty loosely planned.
You said when you graduated from high school, you did this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got to imagine this was a very loose definition of plan.
Yeah, no, I had a map of the United States. I took a blue highlighter and drew a line from Amherst, Massachusetts to California, I think, like Northern California, San Francisco. It just like drew a blue highlighter across the map of the country. And this was the day when you still got free paper maps at gas stations. And so we would come into a state. We'd stop at a gas station, get the paper map of that state, look at our guide, the blue highlighter line, and figure out which highways we would take to kind of roughly follow that line and keep pedaling.
That's interesting because, yeah, when you said you had a map of the United States, I knew there was no chance that you had such an enormous map of the United States that it included all of the roads and highways. That's actually a pretty clever plan to come up with an overall route and then get your individual, closer, localized maps to get that more defined route as you went. So that worked out well, or did it turn into a mess at points?
No, we ended up getting there. A lot of times we were on kind of state highways, that had been bypassed when they put the local interstate in. And so there was less traffic. You know, we'd camp at rest areas or camp on someone's lawn. So, yeah, it worked out. Got us there.
So what kind of bike were you on at the time, and how were you carrying the gear that you needed on your bike?
This was a Raleigh Grand Prix 10-speed. Had a Brooks saddle. I remember that, the leather saddle. Nothing special. I had a pair of panniers. I think they were Jerry panniers, as I recall. And a front bag, kind of a handlebar bag. And that was about it, I think.
So how were you aware of those items at that point? Were you doing a lot of cycling, or did you just know you wanted to do a trip and then somehow you found out that you could purchase panniers and front bags and things like that?
You know, it must have been like we're in the day of paper catalogs. You get a catalog, got gear on it. Now, this was the age of Frostline kits and Holubar kits. My mother was convinced that every kid should leave home knowing how to cook, bake, and sew. And so all us kids know how to do that. And so I was sewing kits. I made my sleeping bag, made a down vest. And then I made some of my own designs too. I slept that summer in a hammock, a nylon cord hammock, not as comfortable as modern hammocks by any stretch of the imagination, but it worked when you're 17.
You don't need a lot of comfort at 17. Your body responds very positively to things.
And especially when you're cycling 80 miles a day.
Yeah, anything is going to feel
anything's
better
good.
Than
it's
that.
It's just good to get off the bicycle seat at that point. But I sewed a tarp out of nylon and a tube of netting that I could like pull over myself that had Velcro on one end. And so I'd put a rope over the trees and do my tarp, and worked great.
So what kind of weather did you hit along the way? Because what time of year was this? Was it summertime?
This was summer.
Summertime. Yeah. So was that a great weather window for you across the board? Or did you encounter some pretty rough stuff?
So I didn't keep a journal. And I don't know why. I probably didn't want the weight of the book and the pen. But I've actually been in touch with the three other guys that did it with me. And in fact, we're loosely planning like a 50-year complete the loop trip where we cycle back across the country going the other way.
I think that's a great idea.
Could be fun. One of the guys wants to write a book on it, so could be fun. I think it'll be a little less camping probably than last time.
Yeah, you probably won't be as happy in a homemade sleeping bag in a homemade hammock in someone's yard this
summer. I would be, for sure. But I'm thinking the other, at least two of them, maybe not. So he kept a journal, and he figured, rightly, you know, this was going to be like a big thing that I've done in my life, and I'm going to want some records of it. So it's fascinating. He was keeping track of expenses, you know, because none of us had much money. But also, I was reading through his journals, like, it seemed like it rained a fair amount. I have no memory of, like, riding in the rain, not one. I don't know. I just remember the good parts, maybe. I don't know.
So either riding in the rain wasn't that bad, or it was so terrible that you've placed it somewhere locked away in your memory.
Either one, yeah.
How many days did it take you guys? Do you remember?
I believe it was 6 weeks. And I guess I should check that with his journal. But yeah, it was like six, seven weeks, something like that.
So if you're going to do a 50-year anniversary ride, that's what, 3 years from now, right?
No, two.
2 years. So you've got 2 years to prepare for this.
Yeah. We got the email chain going, so.
In some ways, you should be able to do it more effectively and better than you did nearly 50 years ago. But in other ways, maybe not.
There's more resources available.
Right.
And I'm kind of thinking, when I have time, of getting on Adventure Cycling site and trying to find some roads that won't be quite as busy. I've had too many friends killed on bikes riding on the road, to try and kind of plan the route a little more than we did last time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll have helmets this time, cell phones.
Yeah, you have GPS to help out. You'll have gear that's tailor-made for these options these days. So this is when you're roughly 17 or 18, and you and your friends get the idea to do this. You get to California. You're not moving to California, right? So then you've got to get back to Massachusetts? Or was this a way for you to leave Massachusetts permanently?
I didn't know it at the time. That's the way it worked out. So the other three guys went home. I think one flied, a couple took buses, one hitchhiked back from San Francisco. I rode down the coast by myself because my dad still lived in the LA area. And so I was staying with them. I don't remember having a specific plan, staying with them for a while.
No, so you took the one down.
Yeah,
to,
took the one
yeah,
down.
That's a beautiful ride.
It's a beautiful ride. I remember riding like in Big Sur with a drop off cliff, like a shoulder of about 6 inches, mm-hmm. and lumber trucks barreling past me with like inches to spare. But yeah, it's a beautiful ride.
Once you get past Big Sur, it's almost all downhill though from there.
Yeah. So I rode to my dad's house and was staying there for a while. And one of his neighbors had a small civil engineering firm and they needed someone to do drafting. So they figured my dad was really smart and I probably wasn't too stupid, so they could probably teach me to draft. So yeah, and that random occurrence, and they offered me $3.50 an hour, and that was like more money than I had ever imagined. And so I took that job, and that's like random occurrence set me on my lifetime career of civil engineering and land development.
In a sense, you kind of accidentally fell into a job when you took a biking trip across the U.S.
Yes.
And then that causes you to move to San Diego.
Yep.
How long do you end up in that region?
So I worked in L.A. for the Calabasas Engineering was the name of the company for a couple years. And then I decided I should get a degree, and I might as well get a degree in engineering since it looked like I was going to do that. And so I went down to, why did I go down to? Oh, I think I met a girl who was going to San Diego State. So, yeah, so I went down to San Diego because she was down there and went to San Diego State for a year. But all the people I knew to work for were up in the LA area. So after 1 year down there, I moved up to Cal State Northridge and finished up school there while I, you know, I could work summers and vacations.
So LA for people can be varied in the experience that it provides, right? For me, when I went out there, it was chasing the entertainment industry, and then I discovered all the outdoor opportunities there that I didn't realize were there. What was your experience there? Because I feel like you would have gotten drawn to the multitude of outdoor opportunities there, or did you not?
I did not. I was focused on school. I was taking like 21 up to 24 units a semester, getting straight A's, and work, you know, working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. So I really didn't do any outdoor stuff. I didn't connect with any. I'm an introvert, so, you know, I didn't join any clubs or really didn't do any outdoor stuff to speak of for a period there.
And so then when did you realize that LA had all these opportunities outside of the city, or did you not?
I really didn't. By that time, I had moved back down to San Diego. I graduated from Cal State Northridge in 83, gotten married in there. And I looked at, since my profession worked better when an area was growing, you know, I looked at the 1970 to 1980 census and did an analysis pre-computer. I'm talking like graph paper and colored circles on maps here.
Right. The same when you're talking about drafting earlier. We're talking about traditional drafting at a drafting table.
Ink on mylar.
Yes. Yep. Blue pencils. And yes.
Yeah. And linen even. Drafting on linen.
T-squares and triangles.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Still have those triangles.
So do I.
Awesome. I still use them. Yeah. So I was down in San Diego and, you know, then I was working down there. I kind of got derailed from the outdoors for a while. Tend to be a workaholic, so kind of got derailed. And it was probably our oldest son, Brian, getting into Boy Scouts that kind of put me back on that track. We joined a very active scout troop in Oceanside, California, and there was like 100 kids. We did the kind of the capstone backpacking trip was a week in the Sierras.
And had you been to the Sierra Nevadas at all at this point?
Just as a kid.
Okay, so more family-oriented day hikes and things around the area.
Exactly. Actually, I did some outdoor stuff back east in Amherst. I was in Boy Scouts, but most of the trips we would go out, we had like a little campground in the woods where each patrol had their little area, and you'd do lashing to make little tables and seats and stuff like that and cook over fire. And that was fun, but it wasn't like you were going on a trip.
I mean,
you're being outside, which was fun. It's when my son got into scouts, so we were doing backpacking trips all the time building up to this capstone in the High Sierra. And so I went to REI, you know, I didn't have my old Kelty pack and all the stuff I'd gotten as a kid at EMS, Eastern Mountain Sports. So went down to the REI in San Diego and was like, we're going for a week in Sierra, what do we need, you know? And they loaded us up with big sleeping bags and big internal frame pack and MSR stoves and pots and all that stuff.
So we are talking about the point where now you can get internal frame packs instead of those big external frame packs.
It was like the new thing.
Right, okay.
Which, in retrospect, I'm not sure was a huge advancement.
Right.
Since I don't remember my external frame green Kelty being that heavy, and the new internal frame pack that was like, oh my gosh, this is great, moves with your body or something. I forget what the sales point was. Weighed 7.5 pounds empty.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the latest and greatest, so that's what we got.
Do you remember where in the Sierra this trip took you?
There's
so many options.
There are, and I don't remember. We have a picture. I have a picture in the book, actually, of Brian and I with these huge packs on somewhere near a lake.
Yeah, I was going to say, there must have been a lake
involved. There must have been a lake, which doesn't narrow it down much.
Yeah, if you're in the Sierra and you don't end up at a lake, then you're maybe hiking the Sierra wrong.
And we did, multiple trips on multiple years, and I know, we've taken the scouts over Forester Pass, we did Silver Pass, I remember some specific names. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a great trip, and that kind of kicked off my reemergence in the joy of the outdoors and backpacking and camping.
Right. I mean, in the Sierra Nevada, no better place to inspire that than somewhere like that. Anyone who's listening who's never been to the Sierra Nevada in Central California should make it a point to get out there at some point. You start out as a kid who will take a bike trip across the entire United States. Then you do the thing that I think many of us do, which is you kind of hit your 20s. You become focused on socializing, building a career, having a family, those sorts of things. And then that family gives you the opportunity to kind of rediscover the outdoors and nature via Boy Scouts, which is something that I actually hear about pretty frequently on this show. So what does it look like from there? Do you continue to just do these family trips with the Boy Scouts? Or do you decide, okay, I want to start doing some bigger, more exciting things on my own?
Well, so through Boy Scouts, the scoutmaster of the local troop was Reed Miller. I met him through Toastmasters, and also he was a client at the first engineering company I worked for down in San Diego, in Vista. About this time, Reed gets Ray Jardine's first book, The Pacific Crest Trail Hiker's Handbook, and starts reading about ultralight. Reed also decides that he's going to hike the Pacific Crest Trail, in sections. And so I start hiking sections of the trail with him. I read Ray Jardine's book, and I still remember this day looking at his gear list in the back with an 8-pound base pack weight. So that's all your gear, everything you're not wearing except for food mm-hmm. and water. I remember Reed and I looking at it going like, 8 pounds. That's like amazing.
That's only a tiny bit heavier than the pack you bought from REI.
Exactly.
Empty.
Exactly. And now, I rarely go out with a base pack weight of more than 5 pounds, but we couldn't wrap our head around 8. I remember closing the trunk of the car after weighing our packs when we broke 12. And we were just giddy with excitement that we had gotten under 12 pounds. But, looking at how the scouts, some of them small, struggled with these huge, heavy packs, and doing a fair amount of hiking with Reed and the scouts really got me thinking, well, that 7.5-pound pack, that's a good place to start, because that thing's huge and heavy.
Yeah, you're not going to get to an 8-pound pack if you're starting with a 7.5-pound pack.
Correct.
Empty. Right.
So since I knew how to sew, I made myself a pack. I ordered some fabric and made a pack. Reed took to calling it the G1, since my name starts with a G, and it was the first pack I made. And being an engineer, as I'm hiking along, I'm thinking like, well, this works pretty good, but I could probably change this. I can make this a little lighter, make this a little smaller. And so I made another pack. And I always tell people when they email me or talk to me and say, I made my first pack. It's like, okay, that's great.
Tell me when you've made your 12th.
Yeah, it won't be your only pack. Trust me. So I made another pack, and in the next few years, I ended up making 4 packs. And by the time I made the 4th pack, the quote G4, I felt like it suited my needs pretty well. I feel like it had been optimized for where I was at that point. And this was early internet days, like listservs and stuff. And word got out that, I made this pack and people were interested. So I put the plans and instructions on the internet. Anyone could make one for free.
And what was your approach with your pack? So you have, the brand new 7.5-pound REI pack with an internal frame. It's the state of the art, but it's super heavy. And you want to make it lighter and you want to change other things. So what was the approach
to get you to your G4 pack? What did you want to change that was very different than that pack?
Some of the main features were lighter materials, obviously, using grosgrain instead of webbing, using lighter nylon, you know, only using heavier nylon on the abrasion areas. I overshot that with the G3, made that whole thing out of sil nylon, and it got shredded on a Sierra Trek that Brian was unlucky enough to be carrying it on. But yeah,
that's the best way to test it, is have someone else carry it. Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of that Calvin and Hobbes. They're driving over a bridge that says, you know, the weight limit, 42 tons or whatever. And Calvin asks his dad, how do they come up with those weight limits? And the dad says, well, they build a bridge and then they drive heavier and heavier trucks over it until one crashes into the river. And then they rebuild it and they know how heavy that truck was. And so, process of elimination and overshooting, I think the main features were lighter fabrics, and then dual use. So we were using Z-Rest pads, you know, the foldable, I forget what they call them now, Z-Lights or something, the foldable kind of foam dimpled pads. And so I would cut one of those and fold it up and slip that in the back of the pack and use that for the frame.
Okay, and then you can also use it for your sleeping pad.
Right, use it for your sleeping pad. And you can, since it's on the outside of the pack in a holder, you can take it out and sit on it during rest stops. And then things like your sleeping socks, you know, you need heavier socks to keep your feet warm at night, or I did, but you're only using them at night. So during the day, those stuff into your shoulder straps and are the padding for your shoulder straps. So trying to use things like that to dual use of materials.
So was part of the goal then to provide the structure of the pack? You provide that structure by using items you're going to be carrying with you already?
Exactly.
Instead of having separate pieces of plastic or metal building that structure for you.
Exactly.
So then once you take everything out of the pack, it just collapses into it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing to it.
Becomes your pillow?
It could, yeah.
So you make four of these. When you're testing these, are you testing them by taking them out mostly on day hikes, or you're full-on invested in going out for a week or so with this pack and hoping that it holds up?
Just going out for a week. I knew it would hold up. It was just, I had sewn it. So that's the great thing about making your own gear, is you can customize it. You can do the stress points. Like, there's a way I like to do lash points that's easier to get a rope through when it's cold. You know, rather than just a simple loop. It's just little things you can do when you're making it yourself. So I wasn't worried about it failing. I was just, would it work as well as it could?
And I mean, I guess the positive and negative when you're testing your own gear is when it is failing, the only person you can get upset with is yourself instead of REI or Kelty or Gregory or whoever else you're going to curse in the moment. So you build four of these packs. And then, are you happy? That fourth pack is great.
Yeah, fourth pack. I think this is perfect. I'm good. I'm done. And I put the plans on the internet so anyone else could make them. But I kept getting calls from people going, "Hey, could you make me a pack?"
Right, because they maybe don't have the skills that you have to make it themselves. Right,
their mom did not teach them how to sew before they left home,
or bake, or cook.
Well, I don't know, but bake or cook isn't going to help you make a pack. But for whatever reason, they couldn't sew, and they didn't know anyone who knew how to sew. Which is sad. So, but it took me at this point, you know, ordering the fabric and then marking it out, cutting it, sewing it. It was about a 10-hour project. And at this point, I'm working 70 hours a week engineering. It's like, no, I'm not going to. One, you couldn't afford it. And two, I don't have the time anyway. But I kind of felt bad that, you know, these people didn't know how to sew and couldn't make their own pack. So I was talking to the ladies in Florida that I got the fabric from, Quest Outfitters. And they said, well, you know, we've got this trade magazine here, and there's a cut and sew operation in Seattle, which is at least on the West Coast. You know, you could try them out. So I contacted them. I figured, based on the calls I'd gotten, that if I could figure out a way to get 25 packs made, everyone who wanted one would have one, and I could go back to doing my engineering.
And is that how you end up accidentally forming a company?
Yes. So I contact Monty up in Seattle. He says, oh, yeah, we've done sewing. We've made gear and packs and all this stuff. Piece of cake. So I sent him up a pack and some material, and he made one. It wasn't quite right. And we're having a conversation one day. He was Cambodian. He says, these not like other packs we make. And I said, yeah, that's kind of the point. This is something different. That's a true statement. I wanted to get 25 packs made. He says, oh, our minimum order is 100.
Yeah, I was going to say, 25 sounds very low for it to be worth anyone's time.
Well, and he said minimum order is 100, which is also very low, but it was way more packs than I wanted at that point. So we went back and forth and finally settled on 50. And I thought, oh, these things are going to be in my garage for the next 5 years, right. But somehow I'll eventually get rid of them, you know, whatever. Let's make 50 packs. Our son Brian put together a rudimentary website where people would kind of fill out a form with their name and address, email address. It wasn't size because for some reason there was only one size. I'd made a pattern of the pack I made. So
right, made
if you happen to be
6'4
with long legs, perfect. You were golden. I have no idea what people shape differently than me, how their packs worked out.
Right, but, because again, you're not trying to start a company.
No.
You're being bullied into starting a company.
Yeah. But for some reason, I thought color would be important. So I offered like different colors instead of different sizes, which I have no idea what my thinking process was on that. But if you're only making 25 packs, like, you know, you don't think that hard about it. And so Brian put together this little website. I started getting emails with these order forms. I grabbed a yellow line pad and started writing down the orders, one line per order. And I still have that yellow pad with those orders.
Is it on your wall somewhere in a frame?
No, there's a picture of it in the book, actually. It's separate sheets now, and it's hundreds of sheets because it was our system for a very long time. And then we started shipping out packs. But before I even received the 50 packs, I had orders for 86.
So you were thinking maybe you should have bought the 100 after all.
So I'm thinking that was my first indication that this might not proceed exactly the way I had envisioned.
When you're starting a business intentionally, an important thing is your brand identity. So your logo, your name of your company, all those sorts of things. But you're not trying to start a company. So have you put any thought into this? Or is it named Gossamer Gear at this point?
No, it's GVP Gear. It's like my initials, like super imaginative.
Okay. Right.
And I did have a little logo. It always cracks me up. Engineers, I think, are particularly prone to this. Because some engineers, and I can say this because I'm an engineer, they think they know everything because they're an engineer. And so it's like, well, I'm not going to pay an artist to come up with a logo. I'll just make it up myself because I'm an engineer.
Yeah, this has been my experience in life knowing many engineers.
Yes. And so, you know, they're very proud. And you can, the minute you look at it, you go, oh, designed it yourself, huh?
They're right.
Like, yeah, of course. You know, isn't it awesome? So I had a little, because G is kind of like a circle and V is kind of like a triangle and P you can fit inside a square. I'd like a little circle, triangle, square. That was my logo.
So that's why I've
pretty
seen
impressive.
That before.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you make this order for 50 packs. Sounds like you actually needed 86.
That was before they even showed up.
Right.
86. Yeah.
Right. So you're GVP at the moment. You're working a full-time job. This is just a thing that's happening on the side because people are pestering you to make packs that you thought you wouldn't need to make because you gave them the plan so they could make it for free without your involvement. But you learned people would prefer to have you make them the pack than figure out how to do it on their own. And outside of whether or not they know how to sew, I can think of a variety of reasons people would rather just pay someone to build them their pack.
Well, sure.
So this is not a big surprise.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, you know, if you're going to make and sell 25 packs, like I wasn't trying to make any money because it's like, so you make $5 a pack, $10 a pack. It's like, it's not going to amount to much money. So it's like, so I'll just charge what they... The first pack sold for $70, and that included priority shipping to deliver it to you. So, yeah, definitely. In retrospect, looking at it like, oh, do I want to spend 10 hours? It took me 10 hours, and I knew what I was doing, making a pack or write a check for $70.
Right.
It's like, oh, yeah, that's an easy call.
Yeah.
So you've got an order for 86. There's only going to be 50 on the way. You're currently GVP. You're still not Gossamer Gear. So clearly a lot of things are about to happen that are going to change the progression of this fourth pack you made that you didn't realize was going to turn into a business. So what's the story there? How do you go from you've ordered the 50 packs, you actually need more, and you're going to turn into Gossamer Gear at some point?
Well, the one thing that didn't change is working full-time. I've worked my entire life full-time as a civil engineer. Never quit my day job. And never took any salary or any money out of Gossamer Gear. It was always just like a side thing. I kept thinking, this is going to go away. So I quickly called up Quest Outfitters and go, hey, we need more fabric. Pronto. And we got more fabric. Monty made the first batch, made the second batch, and was constantly making packs, shipping them down. We were shipping them out. I added a few other items. We would sell the pads. I made some trekking poles. I got, and I don't know why, but there was a guy in England that was selling 10 mil carbon fiber tubes. And I buy those tubes from him. I would buy Lecky tips wherever I could scrounge them, and then I would cut the tubes, and I found some place in Oklahoma that was selling like cork kind of handles, and I would make trekking poles, like fixed length trekking poles in the garage and ship them out.
And did you make the trekking poles for people just because you had decided to make your own and then offered them to people on the internet for free and then they asked you to make them as well?
Yeah. No, that's been my patterns. I make stuff I want. Mm-hmm. And then if other people want that, then they can buy that. I would get people in the early days, particularly, would call up and go, well, you ought to do this, you know, or why is your pack better than whatever? It's like, well, I don't really don't care. I make what I want. And if right. you think that's a good idea, well, that's great. And if you don't, I really don't care. That's the freedom of not making any money at it, is uh-huh. you really don't care.
I mean, to a certain degree, it was almost like a hobby for you more than
it was definitely just a hobby. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our early pack line, the G4 and then the G5 pack and then the G6 was my ultralight progression. You know, the G5 weighed about 8 ounces. The G6, when it was around, weighed like 3.5 ounces. So as my load got lighter and lighter, the packs got lighter and lighter. You know, this pattern really holds today. We just actually, Gossamer Gear just sold out of our first run of the Whisper tent. And that was a tent that I designed because I was going to do 900 miles bike packing on the Great Divide. And I knew it was going to be buggy. But I wasn't going to have my trekking poles, so I needed a tent that would give me some bug protection. I had limited carrying capacity on my gravel bike, and so I needed something compact. So I think I went through 12 different prototypes, 14 maybe, in Tyvek and then DCF, and came up with this tent that I thought was great. And then Gossamer, the question is always, okay, Glenn's come up with a new product. Do we think there are more than 5 people who also think this is a good idea? And we weren't sure on the Whisper, but that's why we had 100 made, but they sold out.
Yeah, and apparently more than 5 people were interested.
At least 100, yeah.
Right. So when does the company become Gossamer Gear? And what makes you decide, let me give it a different name, let me brand it this way?
We'd gotten to the point where I think we were shipping enough. I realized that the initial thing was like, okay, I wasn't thinking about that. This looks like it's real company now. We should have a real name. And I don't know, Gossamer just kind of occurred to me.
Because it's lightweight.
Yeah. One night in a dream or something. So, you know, so we call it Gossamer Gear.
So you are working full-time job. You're also running a business that you didn't intend to start on the side. You're a father. And you're a person that still tries to get out and do these long trips, backpacking trips, bikepacking trips. So how are you juggling all this, and is it very difficult?
Yes, I'm not doing a very good job juggling. I'm working 60 to 70 hours a week on the engineering because I have my own engineering company at this time too.
So you just decided to start multiple companies.
Well, yeah. Well, I started the engineering company on purpose. Yes.
All right, good job.
I knew I wanted to do that. I'm doing about 30 hours a week on the backpacking company between shipping and customer service and managing orders and quality control and everything else. You know, I also volunteered to be on the board of the Pacific Crest Trail Association.
Right, because why not add a few extra things?
Sure. You know, we've got 3 kids. The wife's going crazy at home. One of them's severely disabled. Yeah, so it's not, I realize it's not sustainable. And since at this point I'm making 6 figures on the engineering and exactly 0 on the gear business, it's pretty obvious which one has to go.
Right.
That's an easy call. Not a call I wanted to make. So through my being on the board of the Pacific Crest Trail Association, we had a board meeting and we had a breakout session trying to figure out how to get new board members. Henry Shires of Tarp Tent is in the small group with me, and he says, what about John Mackey? He's a customer of mine. And I said, who's that? And he goes, the co-founder of Whole Foods Market. I said, oh. And when I got home, I looked through my yellow line pad, and it's like, yeah, John Mackey bought a lot of stuff from me, too. I just didn't recognize the name. He'd bought a bunch of packs. If there's a good product, he likes to buy it and buy it for friends, and he's a very generous, loving guy. And so anyway, it's like, oh, yeah, he's a big hiker, and we should pitch him for the board. And at this point, I guess I developed a little bit of some kind of reputation as a guy with a very light pack. John, for whatever reason, was interested in meeting me. So I was kind of the bait, and we went out to Boulder, where he spends some of the summer, with Liz Bergeron, the executive director at that time of the PCTA. And so we had a nice dinner and pitched him on joining the board. So a couple weeks later, and about this time, I decided I got to close down Gossamer Gear. It's just
and how long are you have you been doing Gossamer Gear at this point? Roughly,
this is like 2005, 2006.
So just a few years then.
No, since 97.
Okay.
So 10 years
so
in.
A good decade.
Yeah. About a week or two after we met John in Boulder, Liz Bergeron calls me and says, "Hey, you know, you're the connection with Mackie. Call him up and close the deal. So, you know, see if he wants to join." And so I called John, and, you know, he declined to join, but made a large donation. As we're hanging out, I said, "Oh, by the way, you know, if you want any gear from Gossamer, you should buy in the next couple of weeks because I'm going to close it down." And he said, "I'm leaving on a hike. Don't do anything till I get back."
Don't be impetuous. Just wait till I get back.
Wait till I get back. And so he called me back and says, "I got a proposal for you." He says, "I will pay you $100,000 for 75% of the company. I'll put in a couple hundred grand more, hire someone to run it, and I want you to retain 25%, and you can be as involved or uninvolved as you want." So I said, "Okay." John Mackie is the only reason Gossamer Gear exists today.
That deal must have sounded better than, "Well, I'm just going to shut it down for nothing." It's, "Well, now I'll receive this payment, and I also, if I choose, can continue to run this business." So it sounds like a good deal.
Yeah. No, I didn't see any downside. I mean, you know, the 100 grand wasn't going to change my lifestyle any, but, you know, being able to participate and still have some of the fun parts without having to do the day-to-day part, I was like, yeah, that's a huge benefit.
In a way, it's like you become the resident designer for the company.
Yeah, it's like the best of both worlds. You know, I can be the public face, but I don't have to answer the customer emails. It's like awesome.
And so clearly you said yes to that deal.
Yes.
Now, does it become a little easier from that point to balance all these different aspects of your life? Or did you find that you still wanted to devote a lot of time to Gossamer Gear?
No, I backed off considerably. You know, operations moved to Austin at that point from Carlsbad, where we lived, because Grant Seibel took over. He was the only employee for a very long time. Our current CEO, Jonathan Schmidt, was hired to cut polycryo ground sheets. We'd buy a big roll and then cut it into, you know, 7 foot long pieces and fold it up and put it in a plastic bag. That was like his first job. Now he's running the company.
That's quite a promotion there.
Yeah, that was over the years. He's proven himself. But yeah, so I was, you know, much less involved. I still do public speaking, you know, do the tinkering, answer questions. But yeah, it definitely freed up some time.
So originally, you know, you're building things that you want and then offering them to other people who want the same thing. So once you sell the company and kind of back away from it to a certain degree, are you still designing new products, or is it mostly relying on previous products, or are new designers coming in? Like, how did the company change?
The company changed because, you know, my model of just making what I wanted works great when it's a hobby and I'm not taking any money out of it. All of a sudden, you got employees. This is their job. You need healthcare. You got rent. It's a real company, and you got people that are depending on it. And so you need the number of people that like whatever I design is a limited number. Bigger than I thought, but still a limited number if you're trying to run a big company on it. Yeah, we hired some designers to help design the stuff, you know, better than an engineer would, frankly. I'm glad you know a lot of engineers. You get exactly what I'm talking about.
I don't think you can be involved in the outdoor community without knowing a lot of engineers. It's full of engineers.
That's true. There is like a weird kind of Venn overlap there.
There's definitely, yes.
You know, at that point, and our products became a little more, I mean, they're still light, but not ultralight. So maybe things weigh a pound and a half, and our packs, you know, like the Mariposa looks more like what people expect compared to the G4. It's a little more normal and has some of the features that people like, but it's just a lighter version of that.
Is a lot of that basically trying to balance making things affordable while as light as possible, but not ridiculously light? Because it does seem like a lot of times with the ultralight, to get the weight really down, that cost increases pretty quickly. Is that correct?
It can, based on materials.
Right.
Yeah, some of the materials can be super pricey. But a lot of it is we wanted to meet people kind of where they were. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, you don't have to get your base pack weight down to 8 pounds before you can buy our products.
Right.
It's like, no, let's meet you where you are. And we have people that start with the Mariposa and then they, you know, work their way down a Gorilla and then they're in a Murmur and they start with a tent and then they're moved to tarp. So, you know, we want to help people get lighter wherever they are and to take it as far as they want to take it.
So once you sell the company and it becomes a smaller part of your life, you're still doing your work on the side. Are you open now to like go out and do more trips? Or do you find that your life looks exactly the same as before you've sold the company?
Well, now is different because I'm quote retired. I like to be busy, but that's a hard thing to dial in exactly.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I still had my own engineering company. That folded when the economy tanked. I consulted to the city of Carlsbad and eventually went to work for them. I've always worked too many hours. My wife will attest to that. She says, I don't get it. She says, you're only getting paid for 40. Why are you working 70? And I never have a good answer for that.
Maybe you're not so great at math. Maybe that's what it is.
There are many things I'm not great at. Yeah, and working too much is definitely a sore spot. But, you know, being retired, I mean, I'm involved in probably 3 or 4 companies now and dishwashing. I mean, it's temporarily out of whack now because of the book. That's like a full-time job right now, pretty much. But we still get out a lot. I do a lot of trips. I mean, I did 400 miles bikepacking on the Great Divide last year, a couple backpacking trips. We hiked 400 miles in Europe. We're doing a week-long bike barge trip this spring. I've got a couple of backpacking trips, going to Iceland, doing a trek there. So yeah, we get out. We enjoy ourselves.
So when you started Gossamer Gear, or GVP as it was at the time, were you still in Los Angeles at that time, or you had moved away by then?
We had moved away. So when we moved from Los Angeles, when I graduated in 1983, we moved down to San Diego, San Diego County.
So then you end up in San Diego for a while, and then at some point you end up where we are now, which is Bend, Oregon.
Right, and that was another... I have a friend who's an engineer who just visited us, and he's also an ultralight backpacker, per our previous comment. But they're currently looking at retirement and trying to figure out where they're trying to live. So they just rented their house in Northern California. They rented a house in Portland for 2 or 3 months to like see if that might be a place they want to live. And so when people find out I'm in Bend, they go, "Oh, did you like do a bunch of research and, you know, check things out? I imagine you got spreadsheets." It's like, nope, totally random. It's like, I describe my life as kind of wandering down a dark corridor and then like a door opens. I don't notice it and God pushes me through it. It's right. That's kind of how I describe my life. We were here because we have these timeshare credits. Our son Brian lives in Portland, went to school up here. So we'd come use the credits. There was a hotel in downtown Portland that would accept the timeshare credits. So we would use that. And 1 year, Francie calls up to make reservations and they say, "No, we don't take the timeshare credits anymore." So Francie says, "Well, I'll just pay for it." And I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, we already paid for the credits. Let's figure out how to use the timeshare credits." So she pulled out the book and looked around and said, "Well, there's this place called Bend and there's a resort there that we can stay at with the credits. And it's only a 3-hour drive to Portland." So I'm like, "Let's do it." So we show up to Bend. It's Seventh Mountain Resort. It's like on the way to Bachelor. You know, nestled in the Ponderosas, it's like September, just amazing weather. People are kayaking and rafting and mountain biking. And as Francie tells it, like, she says, within 24 hours, he was looking at homes. And I really think it was 48 hours. But the point
much
is, it's like...
Much more reasonable.
So I was like, "Oh my gosh, this is amazing." You know, I mean, if you love the outdoors, you have to admit, Bend is pretty much like amazing. So anyway, that's how we ended up in Bend.
And so you move up here. I'm assuming both businesses are still in operation at the time, correct?
No. I retired from the city of Carlsbad at the end of 2017.
Okay. So once you move up here, this is post-retirement. This is retirement.
This is retirement. Yep. Built a house. You know, until I started washing dishes at Sparrow Bakery. Yeah, I was retired.
We got to talk about this washing dishes thing. It's come up multiple times. You brought me over to the bakery earlier. Talked about how you were the dishwasher. So what made you decide to start washing dishes at Sparrow Bakery?
That's another random thing.
You're walking down a dark corridor. A light appeared and it was Sparrow Bakery.
And we live here in Northwest Crossing, a stone's throw from Sparrow Bakery, because when we came to Bend, we knew people that lived here or had lived here, and they said, "Oh, you got to go to Sparrow Bakery." Similar to your experience,
Much like I heard yesterday and was told that we had to have ocean rolls. An ocean roll, which is what we both ate this morning.
So, France and I are visiting Bend. We go check out Sparrow Bakery, and have an ocean roll. And then we're kind of walking around the neighborhood and go, well, this is a pretty cool neighborhood. And we're walking down some of the alleys.
48 hours.
This was sometime later, yes. But so this, you know, we found an empty lot. And anyway, that's why we live so close to Sparrow Bakery. It's not an accident. But when we moved up here, when I was working, I would get up at 3:30 in the morning, do my morning routine, and then I'd be at my desk at the city at 5 o'clock in the morning to try and get work done before everyone else got in at 8. And so when I retired and we moved up here, I would wander over to the bakery with my Wall Street Journal and my Ember mug, which you probably noticed this morning, and have a cup of coffee and an ocean roll and read my paper and just generally squander a couple hours very enjoyably. Doing that every Monday, you get to know some of the people, and you might have noticed it this morning. I mean, it's a good group. They get along together. They really take care of the customers. And so I got to know some of them. As I was leaving one week, I noticed a sign on the exit door that said, hey, attention, high schoolers, we're looking for a part-time dishwasher. And I didn't think anything of it because obviously high school's a long way in the rearview mirror for me. Right. And I just retired. I'm not looking for a job.
Right. So, yeah, it doesn't sound like you were qualified for any of the things on this sign.
No. That's another part of the story. But, you know, next Monday, the sign was still there. Monday after that, the sign's still there. And I'm thinking...
And you noticed the dishes were getting very dirty.
I asked my, hey, don't you guys need to take this sign down? I mean, how hard can it be to find a part-time dishwasher, right? And they said, no, we've got some time. We don't need one yet. We're waiting for the right person. That was kind of a flashback to me to like an earlier time when it's like, waiting for the right person. And I thought, maybe God has my name on this. You know, maybe I'm the right person that they're waiting for. So I thought about it. Next time I was in, I said, hey, I'd like to get an application for the dishwasher position. They said, oh, yeah, sure, Glenn. For who?
Okay, so from this point, because I haven't filled out a job application in many, many years, you're technically retired after you've had two separate businesses. How long had it been since you had filled out a job application that you can recall?
I don't recall.
Right.
A very long time.
If somebody handed me a job application right now, I would probably just stare at it for a moment because it's been so long since I've filled one in.
So they hand me a job application. They ask for who, thinking I got a grandkid or nephew or something, you know. Like, oh, for me. And they're like, they kind of shrug and go, okay, well, turn this in with a copy of your resume. And I'm thinking like, copy of my resume for like a part-time dishwasher? No, I always have an up-to-date resume.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Always. Because... I don't know. You never know when you might need to go back to work. My resume is always up to date. But it just kind of cracked me up. And I thought about my resume. It's like, okay, I'm a registered civil engineer in 3 Western states. I'm a licensed land surveyor. Graduated summa cum laude with an engineering degree. I got a master's in business. Started multiple companies.
You might be underqualified for dishwashing. There's no skills that involve dishwashing on this resume.
I mentioned to that. I said, you know, I'm a little... I'm really not. I don't have a lot of professional dishwashing experience on my resume. And they said, Glenn, I wouldn't worry about it. You know, we like to teach people to do things our way. It's like, well, that's great because I have no bad dishwashing habits to unlearn. I filled out the application, updated my resume under interests. I put ocean rolls, and under objective, I put part-time dishwasher, and turned it in. With the cover letter, because
you wrote a cover letter also.
Yeah, right? I wrote a cover letter because
I include references as well.
I did, of course. When I explained in the cover letter, look, you know, I think this might have my name on it, but I don't want to take a job away from someone who needs it,
right?
Because I don't. So if there's someone that needs this job, well, give it to them. Don't give it to me. But I said, having run small business myself, I can see where it might be useful to have someone who lives close. Is generally available at a moment's notice, knows how to do the job, but doesn't need the hours. You know, you don't have to worry about how many hours I'm getting that I'm not going to be able to pay my rent or eat.
Right.
But I've been out gravel biking and, you know, stopped to look at my phone and some guy says, hey, I just got sick. Can you come finish my shift? Yeah, okay, let me ride back home and cover your shift. So anyway, so I got the interview, got the job.
Is it their most rewarding experience of your life?
I don't know, as I say, most rewarding. So the job was Ranger, the guy they had washing dishes on Monday. He was normally baking, but he washed dishes on Monday. He was going to Belize for a couple of months with his girlfriend, I think. And so they needed someone to cover Mondays. And so that was what I was hired for. And then one of the kids broke his wrist snowboarding who did Sundays. So before I even started Mondays, I had to do Sundays. And then Ranger came back and the kid's wrist healed. And so then I was just kind of like, now I'm on call. You know, I worked last Monday. I'm actually working this coming Monday. But generally, you know, a couple times a month, they'll call me like, hey, you know, we need someone this day.
What do you get from it? Because like you said, you don't need the job.
I do get paid. Well, I get paid in gift certificates. I mean, you saw what I used to pay for our breakfast this morning.
That's right. So you get those ocean rolls.
That was a paycheck. And I get it at an employee discount. But one of the huge benefits is particularly if you close, there's a bunch of baked product that is not going to be for sale the next day. When I was working every Monday, I would come home with just bags of ocean rolls and chocolatines and banana bread. And my first plan was, as I'm walking home, I'm texting neighbors. And the neighbors figured out pretty quick, like, hey, Mondays, about 5:30, 6 o'clock, you want to have your phone there. Because if you don't answer the text, he's going on to the next guy.
So you're the Johnny Appleseed of baked goods in
pretty
the neighborhood?
Much. Okay. Pretty much. I think everyone, all my neighbors have lost a little weight since I'm not on a regular schedule anymore. One day I got home and there's only like a couple of ocean rolls left or something. And Francie goes, what? I go, well, you know, I gave them all away on the way home. She says, okay, we got a new program. You come home first. We lay out everything. I'll take what we want. Then you can call the neighbors. So that's our current method of operation.
I think this is amazing that you've decided, sure, yeah, I'm going to be a part-time dishwasher. I think that's an awesome way to handle retirement in addition to everything else and to become the Johnny Appleseed of baked goods in your neighborhood.
You know, some of the benefits are, I got some great advice when I was about to retire. Someone told me, don't say yes to anything for the first year, because when you retire, everyone thinks you got all this time, right, and they try and list you on whatever they're trying to accomplish in the right world. He said, don't say yes to anything. And so I pass on that advice. And I also, the advice I give people looking at retirement is, you know, most people, when they're getting ready to retire, they're thinking of all the things they don't like about work that they won't have to do anymore. Meetings, emails, Zoom calls probably these days, you know, commute, having to be somewhere at set hours. And they don't think enough about the things they do like about work, because those things are going to go away too.
Right, you know, the community, the socializing.
Being part of a team, yeah, the socializing, being part of a common goal, you know, the adrenaline of working and the structure. You know, if you like to get things done, it's like alarm goes off, you got to get there. You know, at the end of the day, it's like, yep, I got stuff done because I had to. I mean, I was scheduled. And so Sparrow, for me, fulfills a number of those things. You know, there's structure of the day. There's that things when things are slammed on a Sunday morning or something. I mean, it's all hands on deck. Everybody's covering for everyone. And I'm meeting people that I wouldn't normally come in contact with, you know, high schoolers, young people. It's just not part of my normal experience. And it gives me a ton of hope. You know, so much, I don't know, people are discouraged about young people today or whatever. But, man, the people who work at Sparrow, man, they work hard. They play hard. They look out for each other. They care about their customers. Mm-hmm. So it gives me hope.
It's interesting because when I was asking what do you get from it, this is kind of what I was wondering if this is what it was. I figured it must be like that social aspect, that staying in touch with people that are younger, because I 100% agree with you. You hear people, you know, as we all age, bemoaning how the young people are different, so therefore something is wrong with them. Whereas if you spend a little time with younger people, you realize there are a lot of positives to the ways that they are different than however I grew up or you grew up or anyone before us grew up. And I could absolutely see where spending the time with them would put you at a point in your life where you think, oh, actually the future is taken care of. I don't have to be one of these grumpy people who just complains about how the future is going to fall to pieces because young people don't know how to do whatever and whatever and whatever.
And a Christmas party. I mean, that's another thing. I tell people, hey, I'm going to my Christmas party. And they go, wait a minute, you're retired. It's like, yeah, well, it's the dishwashing Christmas party.
Maybe they should look into dishwasher opportunities and get their own Christmas parties.
You know, I was told, I'd been working there a couple months and we're kind of chatting during a lull in the back there. And the manager was telling me, yeah, you know, we've gotten some applications from older people before, probably not politically correct, but I didn't take offense. And he said, we've never hired one because they just think it looks like it would be fun to bake or something. And this is a production. I mean, it's not, we're not playing here. It's like stuff needs to get out the door. And he said, you seem like a little different. So we took a chance and I guess it's worked out. I'm still employed there.
I can verify with a history in food service that it can be high stress, high demand, fast turnaround, and you need to be on your game when you're doing it. It's probably the time in my life that my brain was the most functional and useful and efficient was in the times when I waited tables or worked in food service, because you have to remember so many things and do so many things simultaneously. So it's probably doing great things for your brain.
Probably. Hopefully. Yeah.
So speaking of your brain, speaking of retirement, speaking of where you are in life at this point, we're going to get to your book. So at some point you have decided to write a book, which is now available, correct? Or soon to be available? By the time this comes out, it should definitely be available.
Yes. It's coming out April 16th.
Give us the 5 W's or whatever they are. Why did you decide to write a book? What is it about? Why should people read it? All of those things.
It's funny. I had a question the other day. Someone asked, well, why did you want to write a book? I said, no, I didn't want to write a book. If you're probably detecting a pattern here. I did a lot of hiking with John Mackey, and he plans trips, and he likes to hike with interesting people. We're hiking along, and he says, Glenn, you should write a book, because we always end up talking about gear and ultralight techniques and stuff. And I would always say, you know, there's good books out there. I really don't feel like this has my name on it. Over the years, his friends would take up the refrain, like, Glenn, yeah, you need to write a book. You need to write a book. And John said, when he first made the comment, he says, you need to write a book, I'll write the foreword.
And that's at least 0.5% of your book written by someone else right there.
Written by someone who has some standing and following. And I thought, over the years, I thought, yeah, I probably ought to, like, with an offer like that, I probably should take advantage of it. Probably not too many people have someone famous say, hey, I'll write the foreword for your book.
Right,
all you need to do is write the book.
All you need to do, just write the book.
One day I'm washing dishes at Sparrow. Riley's working the barista, and he calls me out. He says, hey, Glenn, I want you to meet my mom. She's visiting from California. So I come out, and we say hi. We chat about, like, places we know. And I had given Riley some extra backpack I had, some sandals and stuff that I wasn't using. And she says, hey, you know, I really appreciate you helping out Riley with some gear. You know, he's into climbing and things like that. She kind of looks at me and says, I hope your backpacking company takes off really soon. You know, so I go back to doing, I thanked her and went back to doing dishes, and I'm thinking, like, oh, she has no idea. She thinks I'm, like, which is a reasonable assumption.
Right. She thinks,
you know,
you're making a living washing dishes, trying to make this backpacking thing.
65-year-old guy, like, you know, he's got this dream of this backpacking company, and he's washing dishes so he can eat while this thing takes hold. And she doesn't know that, you know, it's already doing millions a year in sales. Even with that, I'm not taking any money out of it, you know, because I worked as an engineer my whole life. You know, that got me thinking about, like, okay, well, maybe I should get going on this book and just write some of the lessons I learned along the way as I was lightening my pack and the doors I got pushed through, kind of walking down that corridor, what I learned, and see if it's useful to other people.
So let's talk about the process of writing a book, because anyone who's spent any time writing anything knows that it takes far longer than you expect it to. There are a lot of things you need, a lot of thoughts you need to organize, a lot of editing and rewriting that needs to happen. So when you went into, okay, I guess I'll go ahead and write this book, what were your expectations, and then what did the reality look like?
My response to everyone who was telling me I should write a book was always like, well, I don't know how to write a book. And finally, one guy said, well, just start writing stuff down. You know, you can organize it later. Just start writing stuff down. So I did some of that. But then one day, I'm on a trip with John Mackey and a bunch of his friends. We're walking from Florence to Rome. And I find myself walking this one day alongside a friend of his who is a ghostwriter or collaborator. And she's done a bunch of, like, famous people's books. And suddenly I thought, whoa, this is how you could do it. You know, have someone who can think about how to put a structure together, or at least hold you accountable. Like I imagined, like, okay, we're gonna talk in a week and you're gonna have another 10 pages written or whatever. But I thought this could be a way of, like, making this happen. You know, have someone that would help kind of organize stuff. And she was too busy to do it, but she gave me a couple names, and I talked to them and found someone that, you know, helped with that process. And that was a big part of the process. But then, you know, finding a publisher is a whole other part of the process. You know, I would cold call and I'd think, like, oh, this one's going to be it. You know, it's like a perfect match and da, da, da. And it's kind of weird because, like, I'm known for the outdoor activities, but the book isn't really about I mean, there's one chapter on kind of gear ultralight stuff. So it was kind of a tough book to sell, and publishers were like, eh, we don't really know who the reader is. And
yeah, what category did they ultimately decide to put it in?
It's kind of, I forget, I'd have to look at Amazon. It's kind of part memoir, part self-help, part outdoor adventure.
So it could end up in any of those, on any of those shelves in the bookstore.
Yeah, 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 that's... What I got advice from one guy is this thing to remember, your book can be about a bunch of different stuff, but it's only going to be on one shelf.
Right, right. So pick the one most people look at.
Yeah. But again, I don't really, I'm donating all the proceeds, so I don't really care. I mean, if it sells or not, it's not going to make a difference to my life.
All right. So how much time did it end up eating up to write that book? Because as we know, you like to spend more hours than you have each day trying to do a multitude of things, and you've gotten rid of these other jobs for the most part, so now you need to take on a task that eats up more hours than you have available. And so was that the book?
That was the book, yeah. It was probably, I don't know, overall, I mean, it's been a 2-year process, and, you know, most of it was probably a 10-hour-a-week thing. I mean, it kind of goes in spurts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more than that now because I'm doing podcasts and I'm mailing out advanced right. reader copies and answering emails. And
all right, now you're doing the PR part of
PR
it.
PR part,
right.
Yeah.
So I interrupted you a bit when you were talking about trying to find publishers. So where did you ultimately end up?
Ended up with Forefront Books.
And what are they primarily known for?
They do a bunch of different things. And they distribute through Simon & Schuster. And I just, you know, got the best feel from them. They had a good deal, I thought, in terms of, you know, how it was structured. You know, I know it was meant to be because the people that I've worked with there, you know, it's just like, it's people, they're just the ones working on your book, you know, doing the structural editing or the proofreading or the copy editing or the, but I feel like I've got lifelong friends, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? That's how, you know, I was like, oh yeah, this is where I was supposed to end up. Just amazing people.
So who's this book for? Because I know that's one of the things that you have to figure out, and you have to figure out in your PR campaign. So who listening needs to pick up this book, and what are they going to get from reading this book?
If you want to have a life that's a little bit more about taking less and doing more, if you want to explore how incorporating some generosity and gratitude and curiosity in your life could make it more satisfying, then you'd probably pick something up from this book.
So to me, it sounds like you're publishing this at the perfect time, because I feel like societally, many groups are trying to make shifts in that direction and reducing our impact, changing our lifestyles so they're less oriented around consumption. Those are things that it seems our society is, the directions our society is trying to go, and hopefully will continue. And it seems like this book is a book for people who want to take that path. Would that be correct?
Yes. I mean, I'm always surprised, just like I was surprised when, you know, someone would order a G4 pack and go, this is perfect. It's been what I'm looking for. It's like, oh, wow, that's weird. Some of the advanced readers of the book, you know, it's like, this is great. They'll mention, like, this tip changed my life. You know, I'm always surprised, like, really? Wow, who knew? But that's my hope, that people get a couple things out of it that, mm-hmm. that'll make their life better.
So we haven't said what the name of this book is. We haven't said where people can get it. Let's tell people all of those things.
So the book title is Take Less, Do More, Surprising Life Lessons on Generosity, Gratitude, and Curiosity from an Ultralight Backpacker. And it's available anywhere you get books, literally. Amazon, your local bookstore can order it.
Is this the first of multiple books? Now that you've had this process, do you want to write more books? Or is this a one and done sort of thing? Or do you not know? Are you at the point where you were at GVP, where you're like, well, I made that one pack, people can have it if they want, and then years later you've made tents and trekking poles and various other things?
I am assuming that once I get through kind of the PR phase here, that I will go back to my life. But there's a small warning in the back of my brain that's remembering that's what I thought about when I got those 25 or
that's
50
right.
packs made.
That's right.
That it didn't really end there and took me an unexpected and wonderful path from there. But so, I don't know, at this stage of my life, it, you know, may sell a few copies and that'll be the end of that. And I got plenty of other stuff to do. But it may also develop into things that I don't foresee at this point.
Right. And so you've written this book and you're saying you hope that other people can get a few things from it. But, you know, you've given 2 years of your life to making this thing exist. What did you get from that process? And was it a positive experience for you?
It was a positive experience. And, you know, most of it is the people I meet along the way. That was the unexpected part. I mean, it's kind of cool to have, like, it came out really well, I think, in terms of what it looks like. And that's because I met amazing people that did amazing jacket design. And I don't know how much we sweated over the title and things like that, you know. It's so cool that when you get, like, really smart people together, that's, like, cool stuff comes out of that. But just the friendships I've made, and, like, I wouldn't have met you if I hadn't done this. You
know, I apologize. Just think, if you wouldn't have had to meet me if you hadn't written this.
No, and talk about, like, moving to Spain and stuff. I mean, it's just, like, to me, that's been the amazing part, is the people I've met.
The original reason I started this podcast was to help other people realize the things I wasn't able to realize early in life, which is, hey, there's all these different things available to you. You just have to know where to look for them, and they can accentuate your life in a lot of ways, and then maybe make you a better person or a richer person or have a richer life. But one of the nice things that has happened is it opens this door where I get to meet people from all different types of lifestyles and have real conversations with them and learn interesting things. The book sounds like it has given you a very similar experience in that way, which I will attest is a very valuable, rewarding experience to have that.
Yeah. And I'm lucky that I don't need the book to make me money, so I can afford to just enjoy the ride and the relationships. It sounds like you've figured that out too, that, you know, the richness in life doesn't come from the things, it comes from the relationships.
If the richness in life came from the wealth, then I am in a very bad place for experiencing the riches of life. But yes, it is, those things can be a conduit to the other aspects of life, but yeah, it's certainly not the most valuable part of life. So another thing I think we should let people know about, because we did talk a lot about Gossamer gear, and perhaps there are some people who are not familiar with it, but they would be interested in ultralight products. Besides going out and purchasing your book, what if people want to purchase Gossamer gear products? How do they go about doing that?
Well, they can go to gossamergear.com. It's a real company now. It's a website and all sorts of gear there and stats and stuff. And they will be selling the book. I mean, that's one of the places you can get a copy of the book. And there's a lot of informational. Part of what Gossamer Gear wants to do is kind of teach people, not just sell them stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, teach them the aspects of how to go lighter and how to do things in a way that gives you a better trip, a more enriching trip.
So with hitting up those things, I think we have definitely reached a point where we go ahead and wrap this up. I don't typically come in with a bunch of preformed questions, but I do have a single question that I always end the show with. So now it is your turn to experience this question, which is, based on everything we've talked about today, what is the final thought that you would like to leave the audience with?
You know, if I could sum it up, I have a list on my phone, a note that says tattoos. Now, I don't have any tattoos, and I'm not likely to get any because it would be very expensive. My wife has made that clear. But it's a list where I keep things that, if I was going to get a tattoo, it might be one from this list. And so I will leave people with a thought from my possible tattoo list.
This is not at all where I expected this to go. I love this.
And that is, work hard, be nice, stay curious.
All right. I think those are valuable tattoo thoughts to leave people with. Thanks a bunch for going to Sparrow Bakery with me, treating me to a Gibraltar and a ocean roll, and then coming and hanging out in this park where we're getting lightly snowed on, very, very lightly at the moment. So thanks a bunch.
My pleasure.
Glenn's book, Take Less, Do More, launched April 16th, and he has been on his promotion tour, giving presentations at bookstores, breweries, REIs. If you are interested in going to one of these presentations, visit glennvanpesky.com and look in the events section so you can see if there is an event coming to you. And if you want to keep up with Glenn in general, you can also sign up for his fortnightly newsletter there on his website as well.
And since you're already on the internet, you may as well go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this episode 122 with Glenn Van Pesky. There you'll find photographs of Glenn in action and links to everything we talked about in today's show. And should you want to contact me here at the show, you can do that a number of ways. You can email me, jason@gogetoutside.com, or you can send a text or leave a voice message at 818-925-0106. And if you did enjoy this show, please go to your podcast purveyor of choice. Make sure you are subscribed to the show. And if you would, please rate and review it. But most importantly, please share it with someone who you think would enjoy it. And just a reminder, there on our website, gogetoutside.com, there is a help out page where you can find a number of ways to share this episode, whether it is sharing excerpts of episodes or imagery. And occasionally you can find deals there that help support the show. So while you're on the website, take a quick look at that help out page. Next time on the show, come back July 16th for more from Bend, Oregon. I will be speaking with Marilee Valkus about everything from cycling, racing, backpacking, ski bumming, guiding, and the value of getting other people out in nature. July 16th, Marilee Valkus. See you then. Thank you.